أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. We were discussing verse 187 about the limits of fast, and we discussed وَكُلُوا وَاشْرَبُوا حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَ لَكُمُ الْخَيْطُ الْأَبْيَضُ مِنَ الْخَيْطِ الْأَسْوَدِ مِنَ الْفَاجْرِ ثُمَّ أَتِمُّ الصِّيَامَ إِلَى اللَّيْلِ and eat and drink until the white streak becomes manifest to you from the dark streak, and at the crack of dawn, then complete the fast until nightfall. Only one thing here has remained, and that is the definition of layl, night. The definition of fajr is very clear here. حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَ لَكُمُ الْخَيْطُ الْأَبْيَضُ مِنَ الْخَيْطِ الْأَسْوَدِ مِنَ الْفَجْرِ. The dark streak becomes distinguishable from the white streak becomes distinguishable from the dark streak. Now about layl, there has been this disagreement among especially Shia scholars since old days that whether night falls at sunset when the sun comes and levels with the horizon, or it should go down a little bit until the redness in the east comes up overhead in the sky. They call it Zahabul Humrat al-Mashraqiyya. Sheikh Tabrasi here says something very interesting. He says that layl is ghurub al-shams. Ghurub al-shams is when sun gets level with the horizon and goes down a little bit. And this is, of course, the what we call ghurub. And we wait about 10 minutes after that for maghrib. He says, certainly layl is ghurub. However, the sign for it when you are in cities or when you are in places where there are in mountainous places where you cannot see this setting of the sun in horizon, the sign of it is when this redness in the east comes overhead in the sky. But if, for example, you are in a plain land, and as soon as the sun sets, that is layl. That is the ghurub. Among the contemporary fuqaha, Ayatollah Bahjat, rahmatullah alayhi, and Ayatollah Makarem, who is still among us, and inshallah God, Allah gives him long life, they also believe that night is ghurub, when sun, just like Sunnis, that as soon as the sun goes and levels with the horizon. Other maraji, all of them, they believe no. We have to wait until the redness comes over the sky. So there is a difference between ghurub and maghrib here. For Ayatollah Makarem and Ayatollah Bahjat, there is no difference between ghurub and maghrib. For others, there is a difference. However, again, those who believe the ghurub and maghrib is different, some of them are cautious about Salatul Asr, the Asr Salat, that its time extends until Maghrib, Zahabul Humra, or only Ghurub. Ayatollah Khamenei here is a bit cautious. He says, although he says that Maghrib and the time of breaking fast is when the Humra comes up, however, Salatul Asr should be prayed before Ghurub. Even there was one istifta from him that when we go to Hajj, we pray with Jama'ah in Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi, and they pray before time, 10 minutes before us. What should we do? He says it is not verifiable that they actually perform their salat before us. In a sense, he is hesitant whether layl is maghrib or ghurub. That's why he makes this caution, that you break your fast in Maghrib, but for Asr, for Salatul Asr, you have to do it before Ghurub. So this has been, as I said, many ulama in the past has had this disagreement, and now contemporary ulama also have this disagreement, that what is the definition of layl? Is it ghurub or maghrib? So this is something which Allama Tabrasi in the 6th century has actually mentioned here as well in that definition. So, ثُمَّ أَتِمُّ الصِّيَامَ إِلَى اللَّيْلِ وَلَا تُبَاشِرُوهُنَّ وَأَنْتُمْ عَاكِفُونَ فِي الْمَسَاجِدِ and do not consort with them while you dwell in confinement in the mosques. The verse actually gave permission for having relation with spouses during the night in Ramadan. However, the exception is that if you are mu'takif in masjid, it is not permissible. And i'tikaf is, of course, to confine oneself in a mosque for some time while fasting. Of course, in our madhab, it should be, of course, accompanied by fast. It was mainly practiced in Ramadan because people naturally fasted in Ramadan and then they did i'tikaf as well, so that the fast is accompanied by i'tikaf. In Majmu'ul Bayan, again, Sheikh Tabrasi says that i'tikaf has to be accompanied by fast, but there is disagreement among Sunni ulama. Sometimes we think that the fiqh issues are point of difference between Sunni and Shia. But if you go to Sunni mazahib, you see that amongst themselves, the differences are much more than the difference which exists between Shia and Sunni. Here he says Abu Hanifa, Malik, and Malik, they believe the same thing, like us, that i'tikaf should be accompanied with fast. However, Shafi'i, he believes that it is acceptable to do i'tikaf without fasting. Well, of course, in our mazhab, it would be meaningless to do i'tikaf without fasting. But anyhow, this is in mazhab of Shafi'i. And also, in Shia mazhab, i'tikaf cannot be less than 3 days. You cannot do 2 days i'tikaf, for example. However, for Abu Hanifa, only 1 day is acceptable. Malik ibn Anas says that it cannot be less than 10 days. Apparently, his evidence is that Prophet usually did i'tikaf for the last 10 days of Ramadan. And for Shafi'i, there is no limit at all. So he said even 1 hour, you can confine yourself to a mosque and call it i'tikaf. Now, where can we do i'tikaf? As is mentioned here, وَلَا تُبَاشِرُهُنَّ وَأَنْتُمْ عَاكِفُونَ فِي الْمَسَاجِدِ. So there is no i'tikaf in anywhere but a masjid. So you cannot do it in a center. You cannot do it in a Husayniyah. It must be in masjid, as the verse says. وَلَا تُبَاشِرُهُنَّ وَأَنْتُمْ عَاكِفُونَ فِي الْمَسَاجِدِ. In a sense, the sentence defines the place of i'tikaf. However, which masjid? Again, this has been a point of discussion among the jurists. He says that i'tikaf la Sheikh Tabrasi. I mention Sheikh Tabrasi because he's very ancient in compared to our time, to see that these rulings has been continuous in history, in Shia history. He says only in 4 masjid i'tikaf is permissible: Masjid al-Haram, Masjid al-Nabi, Masjid al-Kufa, and Masjid al-Basra. These are the only masajid which are permissible to do i'tikaf. وَعِنْدَ سَائِرِ الْفُقَهَا يَجُوزُ فِي سَائِرِ الْمَسَاجِدِ. However, the Sunni fuqaha, they say that in any mosque is permissible, except Malik, which says only in Masjid al-Jami'. Usually in old days, every city had one mosque in which Jummah prayer used to be performed, and that they called it Masjid al-Jami'. It was not like now, I'm talking about the Sunni world, because in Shia world, this has been always the case, that 2 Jummahs were not held in one city, only in Masjid al-Jami'. In Sunni nowadays, they do Jummah in every mosque. However, in old days, there was only one mosque, which of course was called Masjid al-Jami' or Masjid al-Jum'ah. They both names were given to it, in which the the Jummah prayer was performed, and Malik says only in this mosque i'tikaf is permissible, so Masjid al-Jami. Now, in our about our fuqaha, what they say is that I have seen the fatwa of Ayatollah Bahjat, Tabrizi, Fazil, Makarim Shirazi, Wahid, Shubairi, Safi. They say that only in the four masjids, Masjid al-Haram, Masjid al-Nabi, Masjid al-Kufa, and Masjid al-Basra, and Masjid al-Jami. So a mosque in which the Jummah prayer is performed. It doesn't have any meaning in London, of course, or nowadays in many cities, even Jummah prayer is not performed in masjid. In Iran, for example, it takes place in university and such places. Therefore, Masjid al-Jami' has not any meaning in cities like London or in any city in Britain. However, these maraji', they say only in Masjid al-Jami', if there is Masjid al-Jami', actually, or one of the four only. Ayatollah Bahjat as Masjid al-Mada'in, Masjid al-Barasa as well. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, says the four masajid, as I mentioned. If you want to do it Masjid al-Jami', you do it raja'an. Maybe it is acceptable. Do it just that Allah, I do it. I don't know whether this is correct or not, but you give me sawab for it. This is the meaning of raja'an. For example, about Salatul Wutayra, the two sitting salat that we do after after Isha, for Musafir, the traveler, the ulama don't know whether it is something which has been recommended or not, so they say do it raja'an, with the hope that Allah gives you thawab of it. Here as well, raja'an. Ayatollah Khamenei, I think, is the only marja who says in any masjid, raja'an, apart from those four masajid, in any masjid you could do it raja'an. And that is why our youth now doing i'tikaf in any masjid in London or wherever, they do it raja'an with the hope of sawab. Ayatollah Sistani, he says only in Masjid al-Jami', apart from those masajid, only in Masjid al-Jami' is acceptable as well. There is no raja'an for him. However, provided that the imam of Masjid al-Jami' is adil. Why he actually has added this, that the imam is adil? Because usually, especially in Iran, this was the case. I don't know whether this was the case in Iraq. The imam of Masjid al-Jummah or Masjid al-Jama was appointed by the government, by the Shah at the time of Shah, was appointed by him. And of course, ulama did not regard that person to be adil, to be appointed by a Jair Sultan. So he adds this, that provided the imam of Masjid al-Jama, in a sense, not supporting the government by going and doing i'tikaf in Masjid al-Jami'. Anyhow, so وَلَا تُبَاشِرُوهُنَّ وَأَنْتُمْ آكِفُونَ فِي الْمَسَاجِدِ, and do not go close to them while you are doing i'tikaf in masajid. تِلْكَ حُدُودُ اللَّهِ فَلَا تَقْرَبُوهَا, these are Allah's boundaries, so do not approach them. This is a very sort of terrifying sentence or rejoinder at the end, that do not tamper with these things. When I say start from Fajr, do not tamper with the meaning of Fajr. I mentioned what's the meaning of Fajr. When I say finish at Layl, do not tamper with the meaning of the Layl, or do not tamper with the definition of i'tikaf and such things. Of course, we see the jurists, mashallah, especially not Shi'i jurists only. You see, among the Sunnis, the difference is much more. So, because they talk with speculation, conjecture, most of the time, the evidence is contradictory sometimes. They cannot find the evidence. That's why we say we need someone who talks out of knowledge, not out of than, as the mujtahideen do. That's why the Shia says an imam is always needed to explain these things for us. Now that we don't have the imam, of course, we refer to maraji. But the Sunni scholars, they do not believe that an imam is needed at all. And when an imam is not needed, we see these differences. Anyhow, in the Quran about these hududullah, boundaries of God, always this sort of strong statement is mentioned. Do not get close to these boundaries. Do not trespass these boundaries. Do not get close to them at all. There are certain things which are defined for us in terms of worship, in terms of our social relations, and in terms of certain matters which we usually differ. Like, for example, whether it's good to take alcohol or it's not good to take alcohol. I don't mean in Muslim community. Generally, human beings differ on this. Some say, okay, there are benefits in it. Some say the benefits would outweigh the harms. Some say otherwise. Or relationship between men and women, what are the limits of it? Allah mentions these things in the scripture, not only in our scripture, in previous scriptures as well, so that human beings stop arguing about these matters and follow what Allah has mentioned. And Allah calls them hududullah. Allah has set boundaries for you, although naturally human nature can trespass these boundaries very easily. However, Allah said, do not trespass these boundaries. This is the boundaries that I have set for you so that you only move inside them. تَلْكَ حُدُودُ اللَّهِ فَلَا تَقْرَبُوهَا كَذَلِكَ يُبَيِّنُ اللَّهُ آيَاتِهِ لِلنَّاسِ. In this way, Allah explains his ayat, because one of the ayat was fasting, كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ السِّيَامُ, but there was no explanation for it. Now Allah explains those ayat for you. لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَّقُونَ. So the verses about fasting started with taqwa. كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ السِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. So that you increase your taqwa by fasting. And how now Allah ends with, again, لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَّقُونَ. I explain this so that they find taqwa by practicing it. Verse number 188 deals with a completely different thing. وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ. If you remember, I said that the Surah Baqarah was probably the only surah which was revealed over a long period of time. The first ayat of it were revealed when Prophet arrived in Medina. The last ayah of that was revealed to the Prophet, they say, is also in Surah Baqarah, 282 or 3. وَاتَّقُوا يَوْمًا تُرْجَعُونَ فِيهِ إِلَى اللَّهِ. One of the views about the last verse revealed to the Prophet is this one. So it is stretched over 10 years, and therefore there were many different rulings coming down, and any ruling which came down, Prophet actually said, put that in Surah Baqarah, in some place that he specified. So sometimes we see that there are different topics which have no relation with each other, are mentioned in Surah Baqarah. So this is a different topic. وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ وَتُدْلُوا بِهَا إِلَى الْحُكَّامِ لِتَأْكُلُوا فَرِيقًا مِنْ أَمْوَالِ النَّاسِ بِالْإِثْمِ وَأَنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ. Do not eat up your wealth among yourselves wrongfully, nor proffer it to the judges in order to eat up a part of the people's wealth sinfully, while you know that it is immoral to do so. One other of the hududullah is this personal property, which has to be honored and respected. And the way this personal property could be exchanged, the way this personal property could go from one person to another person, is also defined. And there are certain ways which is not permissible certain ways which are strongly prohibited, like, for example, riba. Riba is another way that a property from one person can go to another person, but Allah calls it a declaration of war against him. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اتَّقُوا اللَّهُ وَذَرُوا مَا بَقِيَ مِنَ الرِّبَى إِن كُنْتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ. And if you do not do that, فَإِن لَمْ تَفْعَلُوا فَأَذَنُوا بِحَرْبٍ مِنَ اللَّهِ. It's very, very strong here. It seems quite unreasonable why Allah makes this sort of strong statement about riba, that it's like declaring war against Allah if, for example, you take riba from each other. So these are other, actually, aspects of hududullah. Do not eat up your wealth among yourself bil batil. Batil means not on the way which is acceptable to Sharia. This is the meaning of batil. There are different types of this batil, which can be a point of exchange, a way of exchange of or conveyance, transference of property from one person to another. One is dhulm, as Sheikh Tusi here mentions. Dhulm, betrayal, khiyana, stealing, usurpation, these are batil sort of transference of property. Or for example, taking the taking the mal of the property of orphan, it goes under one of these things. And the other way of this transference bil batil is by gambling, by sort of playful things which would, without any scruples, transfer money from one person to another person. These are أَكْلُ الْمَالِ بِالْبَاطِلِ وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ. There is a hadith from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. It says, كانت قريش يقامر الرجل في أهله وماله فنهاهم الله عن ذلك. Quraysh were gambling over one's property and wives. When they started to gamble, after they lost everything, for example, then they wanted to somehow put another bet. They bet over their wives, that if, for example, you win in this turn, my wife goes to you. Allah is actually advising, do not do such exchange of property amongst yourself. And in other verses, of course, Qamar is mentioned, إِنَّمَا الْأَنْصَابُ وَالْأَزْلَامِ إِنَّمَا الْحَمْرُ وَالْمَيْسَرُ وَالْأَنْصَابُ وَالْأَزْلَامِ رِجْسٌ مِنْ أَمَلَ الشَّيْطَانِ. Maysar is gambling. And unfortunately, nowadays gambling has become part and parcel of human life. Of course, not Muslims. Muslims are honored in this sense by avoiding gambling, drinking alcohol, having undue sex relationships. This is really an honor for Muslim community, that other communities don't have it and they regard it permissible. And they promote it sometimes. And many of the monies which we see are given to charities, are supporting political parties, and other things, bitcoins and such things, come from casinos and gambling, isn't it? They regard it permissible, and I think we have to boast as a community to have been purified from such things, although some Muslim individuals do it, but as a community, I think we have to really be proud of being away from such things. So, وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ وَتُدْلُوا بِهَا إِلَى الْحُكَّامِ. It means, وَلَا تُدْلُوا بِهَا إِلَى الْحُكَّامِ لِتَأْكُلُوا فَرِيقًا مِنْ أَمْوَالِ النَّاسِ. And do not somehow take these arguments or litigations, take these litigations to the hukam, judges, so that by taking it to them, you unlawfully take property of other people. Now, by taking these litigations to hukam means, for example, you know that you have no right over something, but you make a case in the court with a very expert lawyer to actually take the property of someone else. Or another meaning of it is to pay bribes to judges to take property of other people. So there are two meanings for it, tudlubuha ila al-hukam, either by going to hukam, for example, making false, bringing some false evidence or false qasam, as we have one hadith from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, sorry, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam again, يعني بالباطل اليمين الكاذبة يقتطع بها الأموال. To make a false swearing, swear lies to take the property of other people. This could be done in the court. When people take wrong cases to court, they have different means to actually succeed in that. By, in of course, Muslim courts, they used to swear lies, or for example, there were properties of orphans in their hands, and they take some of it, they took some of it, they gave some others, and then they went to the court to prove that no, whatever was used was lawful. These sorts of things, ولا تأكلوا أموالكم بينكم بالباطل وتدلوا بها إلى الحكام لتأكلوا فريقا من أموال الناس, to eat up part of people's wealth بالإثم, بالإثم, sinfully. Of course, again, about this earth, people has given some instances like testifying falsely and other things. And when it talks about amwal al-nas, it shows that in the Quran there is a respect for people's property. People's, the right to have private property is honored in the Quran. وَأَنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ, and you know that these things are wrong. Every human being, by nature, it doesn't need Allah to tell us that do not do this, that this is wrong. These are part of those universal ethical areas which every human being knows. Taking other people's property by bilbatil is wrong. Taking litigations to the court with false evidence is wrong. Every human being knows this. It's not something which is specific to Islam. That's why Allah says, وَأَنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ, and you know that you are wrong in doing this. And there is one hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, just to wind up. علم الله أنه سيكون في هذه الأمة حكام يحكمون بخلاف الحق فنهى الله تعالى المؤمنين أن يتحاكموا إليهم وهم يعلمون أنهم لا يحكمون بالحق. Allah knows that in this ummah there will be judges who do not judge correctly, who do not judge justly, and if cases are taken to them, they would wrongfully judge. And Allah said, do not take, this is one instance of it, do not take your cases to those judges who are unjust in their ruling. That's the end of this verse. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi tahirin.
Thank you very much indeed. We started the
Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Two very simple clarification. One is unjust, judges unjust in their ruling. Do they mean that corruption was prevalent then as well, yes?
Especially at the time of Banu Umayyah, yes.
Yeah.
Very much yeah. prevalent, yeah. yes.
My other point was relating Masjidul Jamia or Juma Masjid. So Masjid is Masjid. So what is the Shia Fuqaha definition of Masjidul Jamia? Is it Shi Masjid or Allah's Masjid?
No, they never have mentioned Shi or Sunni. But Masjidul Jamia was a Masjid. As I said, nowadays we don't have it. In which Juma prayer was performed.
Delhi, for example, that I visit, has Masjid al-Jamia. So there's no distinction between
Shias. No. There's no distinction. If they allow you, Shias want to go and have a etikaf in London Central Mosque, they wouldn't allow them.
You reckon? I don't know. You're making the statement. You think they wouldn't allow?
Some of our friends have been there to pray.
Yeah.
They have insulted them even during the prayer, for example. One of them was in sajda. They brought a chair and put on his head so that he couldn't get up. Well, these may have been rare instances, not by the authorities of the mosque, but by the people who come there.
Yeah. Should we continue discussing this a little bit more, because it is a very interesting subject?
Yeah.
So there is something called provocation, isn't it? So if I go to a Sunni mosque, I try and avoid not using a turba, for example. Do you think that is wrong, or do you think that is right?
Well, you cannot use the turba if you are in the state of taqiyya. And taqiyya has two meanings. One is to protect one's own self. This is one meaning of taqiyya. The other type of taqiyya, which I mentioned, at-taqiyyatul mudarati. Mudarat means that you don't want to break unity. And that's why you, for example, do not use them. However, even using them should not be provocative for people of other mazahib. For example, is it provocative if a Sunni come to our mosque and pray with their hands tied? We understand it. We understand very well why they do it. And even if we think if they don't do it, their salat is not correct because they have to follow their faith. So maybe there should be some respect from the other side as well. That they say, okay, they are acting according to their faith, and we have to respect it. But of course, this is something that their ulama have to explain for the lay people. Otherwise, if the ulama also provoke the lay people, these things would happen.
But looking at the reality, the society, and looking at the numbers, and looking at within the Sunni, the numbers that necessarily don't understand the Shi'i madhab well, isn't it safe not to? And also, for example, to drop kunut in your prayers as well. It is mustahab.
Kunut is mustahab anyhow.
Yeah. So in other words, if we do that, they might reciprocate better. In other words, if we try and do least provocation, in fact, I would even suggest, if you, for example, were leading Salatul Jama'ah here, and if there were 10 Sunnis, I would love you to, I cannot ask or recommend or request you, I'd love you to drop kunut, for example, in the prayer.
Well, it has different sides, the argument has different sides, because there were some Shia communities who did this in some areas, and they completely forgot their fiqh, you know, and they became like Sunnis. And I think to somehow raise the level of understanding between the two would be a better choice. However, yes, even now our fuqaha say when you go to Masjid al-Haram, Masjid al-Nabi, you don't need to put mohr, a turba, because this may, of course, cause some provocation. So the ulama are aware of this as well. We always have to strike a balance here, I think, so that we do not completely erase whatever is recommended by our a'imma and do not, of course, provoke others.
Okay, thank you. Any sisters? No? Doctor in front?
Assalamu alaikum. Strange not to mention Bayt al-Maqdis for Atikaf.
Yeah, no one has mentioned that.
Why is that?
Because at the time of the Prophet, peace be on him, there was no mosque there, isn't it? The mosque was built later on. And therefore, it is something that, although the Quran mentions Masjid al-Aqsa, however, that masjid was not masjid by the definition of Islamic mosque, isn't it? It was a masjid built by Nabi Dawood. Subhana alladhi asra bi'abdihi laylan min al-masjid al-haram ila al-masjid al-Aqsa. Allah calls it masjid and is honoring the place of that temple and the area that Prophet went to Miraj. However, you know, the masjid was built there at the time of the second caliph. So probably that's one reason. The other reason is that these four are specified, and there are many other mosques which may have quite honorable status, but only these are mentioned for itikaf.
The second thing is, I cannot understand how it comes you do mubashara with your spouse while you are in a masjid, mu'takif. I mean, the ayah says, وَلَا تُبَاشِرُونَ وَأَنْتُمْ عَاكِفُونَ فِي الْمَسَاجِدِ. How it comes?
Yes, it's possible. And that is when, for example, your house is very close to the mosque. Because when you are in the mosque, when you are in the mosque, you can go out for call of nature, isn't it? And you have to go out for call of nature. You go home for call of nature, and it's possible that you... Yeah. Of course, not in the mosque, certainly.
Thank you very much. Any sisters? Any brothers? Yes, Riaz.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Thank you very much for the lecture. Sheikh, just again, a small point of clarification. You mentioned right at the beginning of the talk regarding the time of breaking the fast, and we had a discussion around whether it should be at Tulu Shams or 10 minutes after. But then I think I heard you say that some ulama actually allow, or some marja actually allow for breaking of the fast. Did I understand that right? At the time of
Ghurub, yeah. Ayatollah Makarem, yes, says Maghrib is Ghurub. They are the same thing. Yeah.
Yes, but is there any sort of dispensation for when you're in Makkah, for example? Because I think that it can become very difficult to wait another 10 minutes to break your fast.
Yes,
and
yes.
Also for the prayer. Is there any special dispensation from the other marja, or is this
no,
just...
No, it's everyone should follow their own marja. Sometimes some of the maraja, especially in old days, were very adamant that it is ghurub. I remember I read in one of the writings of Allama Tabatabai or someone else, I'm not sure, that Ayatollah Ghazi, the teacher of Ayatollah Tabatabai and others, the great mystic who is buried in Najaf, they say we used to go to his house in Ramadan, and there was a lecture after the Salatul Jama'ah and lecture after Salatul Jama'ah, and I don't know whether they had iftar there or not, but they say that he purposefully, as soon as Ghurub came, 10 minutes before Maghrib, he had his tea, and then we had to wait for another 10 minutes. So he wanted to show adamantly that Ghurub is identical with Maghrib. But in what you are asking, everyone should follow their marja, certainly. Yeah. Even Ayatollah Khamenei, who says it's not verifiable, he says for iftar, you have to wait 10 minutes. Yeah.
Thank you. Any sisters? Brothers? Yeah, Safraz.
Assalamu Sheikh. Sheikh, if you come back to the question of turba for a second, is it wajib only in wajib salat to have a turba? Is it wajib at all, or is it just recommended? And more importantly, for nawafil, or if an ayat of the Quran is recited, which requires sajda. For example, if somebody recited here, do we go scrabbling around looking for turbas? Can we just say, do a sajda?
In ayatul sajda, they say, yeah, it's caution to prostrate over something which prostration is acceptable. But for salat, there's no difference between nafila and wajib salat. It is wajib to do sajda on something which sajda is acceptable. And in our fiqh, the main difference between Shi'i fiqh and Sunni fiqh is that sajda should be performed on something which is either from the earth or grows from the earth, but not audible, something that we could eat. So it doesn't need to be a turba. It can be a piece of paper, it can be a piece of wood, it can be a leaf. Usually in Mecca, as you know, people take these straw mats with them, and they do sajda on that. So there may be different ways to somehow avoid provocation, although there is always provocation from other side as well. Sometimes I have noticed, for example, they come and they take the straw mats so that you do not do sajda on a straw, do it on the carpet, which of course is, I mean, as I said, these extremist actions come mainly from provocation from the ulama of these sects, which provoke people to do such things. Otherwise, if they educate that these differences exist between Sunni and Sunni mazahib as well. So, coming back to your question, no, it's wajib in both nafil and in wajib salah.
Thank you. Any sisters? No, Riaz, and then after. Nizar, and then Riaz.
Sheikh, one quick comment and then a question. The comment is, provocation, if you do not get provoked, I think the provocator has lost and you have won. Mm. And for you not to retaliate, he has lost even more.
Absolutely, yeah, true, okay. Absolutely.
So just a statement there. I wanted to just open the discussion, and I say it with the greatest respect, so nobody should misinterpret me. You said a couple of times you follow your Maharaja. Now, if my Imam of the time was present, I would 100% follow him, absolutely, because he has got divine guidance. No human being possibly can have knowledge on everything. If I refer a patient to a consultant, if we bring consultants in the medical world, a consultant specializes in kidney disease, heart disease, brain disease, whatever. So then we follow that consultant. Yeah, but I mean, quite by and large, a consultant giving an opinion on a heart disease, a consultant specializing in heart disease, giving an opinion would be followed rather than a neurologist, brain specialist, giving an opinion on the heart. Although it does happen, actually, that the neurologist gives an opinion about the heart, although the patient has already seen a cardiologist who has said something different. So these things do happen. At the Maharaja level, of course, we cannot, not for a moment, and I must clarify this, and I don't want people to misunderstand me, that not for a moment can we compare the Maharaja to the consultants. Consultants become consultants within 10 years, and sometimes even lucky, earlier, as some of our younger brothers are. But Maharaja have taken decades to reach the state and the level of knowledge that they have reached. But wouldn't life be wonderful for a Shia that you follow? Maharaja is a Maharaja, by definition is a Maharaja, full stop, is a top. No matter where he's from, Iran, Iraq, Lucknow, wherever, he's a Maharaja, full stop. Wouldn't it be wonderful for everybody of us to say, you follow any ruling from any Maharaja at any time, provided it is a ruling from a Maharaja, full stop?
Well, this has been a long discussion, an old discussion, actually. But the point comes when the issue of a'lamiyya comes in. But okay, we have to follow the most knowledgeable. Actually, nowadays, even our Maharaja say, if you think that Maharaja, there are a couple of Maharaja who are equal in their knowledge, you regard them to be as knowledgeable as each other, you can follow some of the rulings from one and some from the other. So in this matter, there is an agreement. However, if, for example, we know that someone excels in knowledge from another person way far, then it is not reasonable for us to say, because, for example, this Marja gives a ruling which is more facilitating, more expedient, then I follow him in this ruling, because then we are betraying our knowledge of following the person who we know that knows better, like any consultant as well, that we usually want to get advice from the best one. However, there's another point here, and that is the chaos which is created. Now, the ulama say you either have to be a mujtahid, and if you are a mujtahid, you have no right to do taqlid. And this is very difficult, isn't it, to become a mujtahid, and then you have to find rulings about everything yourself. Or if you have become mujtahid in one area, you cannot follow anyone else in that one area, although you can follow other in other areas. Or you have to follow a marja, or you have to be actually the opposite of what you say, acting based on precaution, ihtiyat. Now, usually we say acting on the opposite of ihtiyat. We take whatever ruling is more expedient for us. But they say, if you are not a mujtahid and if you are not a muqallid, then you have to take the ruling which makes you, which assures you that you have, to the best of your knowledge, have followed the Sharia. And that is, if one mujtahid says something is permissible and the other mujtahid says it's not permissible, you take the impermissibility. So this is the meaning of ihtiyat. We haven't had in Shi'i history of jurisprudence anyone saying the opposite of ihtiyat, that you take anything which is expedient. Yes, Dr. Surush had a discussion on this, and that was that we want to follow something that we think is the ruling of Allah, and taking the expedient would actually fulfill what we want. But as I said, this needs, again, the scholars of the field to come together and say that it's permissible. Now the scholars don't say that it's permissible. They say the opposite should be actually done, doing based on ihtiyat.
Thank you. Sisters? No, Riaz Kako, I think you're there.
Thank you.
Yes, Kako, Ed. Yes, yeah, Mr.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Thank you so much. Difficult subjects again, but can we just quickly clarify that this i'tikaf ayat, because there seems to be some kind of separation to where it says tilka hududullahi fala taqrabuha. Now, I'm limited in my knowledge of Arabic, absolutely, but taqrabuha does relate to the feminine, and is it not possible that they're only talking about going near the women during i'tikaf when he's so strict about?
No, telka refers to these rulings, and because it is, there are different rulings, so the mu'annas is used for them. Telka refers to the rulings, and fala taqrabu, those boundaries. Telka hududullah.
Not the one sentence that came just before.
No, it doesn't refer to female at all. Hudud is feminine. Yes.
So that applies to that.
Yeah.
Just a quick one about the rest of it, each's property. Recently, I've had a case to go through some probate matters, and there's something called living will. I'm just wondering, it's a matter of registering with the courts of the land here in England, right? So does the Islamic system have something similar where there are judges and courts and they have to keep all documents and everything relates back to them in terms of inheritance? Does it happen in maybe Iran or Saudi?
I don't know what is living will, but yes, of course, after a person passes away, there is something called Inhisar al-Waratha. So they have to verify who are the heirs and what are the property, all the documentation. There shouldn't be a claimant heir, for example, which people don't know, so they have to announce that such a person has died. If anyone has any claim as an inheritor, should come forth. And for that, they have to know the record of all the property of the person and everything, yes.
So, I mean, is this ayat specifically for a case that might have happened at the time? And as the
Rasul, no, you can make up these things, you know. You can always make up documents, evidence, so it's general, yeah.
Any sisters?
Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh.
Just to go back to if our Sunni brothers or sisters visit our mosque, wouldn't it be possible for us to explain to them that we use turba for this and we are going to do kunut and it's mustahab, it's up to you whether you do it or not, rather than avoiding the whole thing?
Yeah.
Because we all need a turba, even if we have 10 visitors of Sunnis, we still need to use our turba and we also need to do our kunut.
Well, my view is that if we do not do, perform things the way we do when we are alone, it becomes a bit hypocritical. And we should avoid that. They should know that when they come to our mosque, this is the way we pray. Exactly the same way as we go to their mosque. We don't expect them to do qunut, and we don't do qunut when we are praying with them. We don't expect them to go out of their way for unity. And I think when they come to our mosque, the same thing. They shouldn't expect that we go out of our way and forego some of the practices that we do for unity. As I said, then they say, you see, these Shias do taqiyya all the time. They don't do these things in front of us, and they do it when we are not there. It may be not very good.
Sister, you have a question? No? Murtaza? Yeah.
Sheikh, this is an important subject. I'm grateful for Nizar to bring it up. I think we need to actually, within ourselves, understand that there's a difference between provocation, ignorance, and intolerance. Let me try and explain my thought process by giving you an example. So if, for the sake of argument, I was in a Sunni mosque, and I was praying with the turba. Is that necessarily provocation? Am I provoking that person to react to what I'm doing? Or am I just following my fiqh? That's a question for us to ask. Then imagine there's one of my Sunni brothers who sees me with the turba, and he's ignorant of the fact that Ahle Shia would pray in this way. So he would come up to me and say, brother, this is something you're doing wrong. This is shirk, you're putting a stone. Are you worshipping the stone? What's going on here? Right? That is my responsibility to educate him as to what I'm doing. So his reaction to me initially is just from, if you like, benign ignorance. He didn't know. And he's trying to correct me because he thinks I'm making a mistake. So then it's my responsibility to actually make him understand. And then it is his to either accept what I say or not. Give you another example of that same situation where somebody comes and he full well knows that the Shia pray in this way. He knows exactly the reason why. But he's intolerant of it. He doesn't like it. So then he might come and kick away my turba or do something which is, where is the provocation here? Is he trying to provoke a response from me through his intolerance? Or was I provoking him at the beginning by following my fiqh? These are questions that we need to actually answer ourselves.
Yeah.
And then we would know if our action is provocation or actually just following our fiqh.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in the modern world, especially here in the UK, where people are following different mazahib, different religions, it should not be a difficult question that when we pray with Sunni brothers or they pray with us, we have to tolerate each other. At least, I mean, even if we don't say that, we have to somehow give due right to each other to have to follow. In fact, in Shi'i fiqh, it's very interesting. If a Sunni converts to Shia, had he not followed his own madhab before, for example, he was praying like us before, he has to do qadha of all those prayers. Was he following his own madhab and then converts and tries to do the things in the new way, then the old prayers are acceptable because they have followed their mazhab. I think this shows the ultimate tolerance that Shi'i mazhab has with regards to other madhahib, that yes, they have been following their own fiqh. Here in the UK, I think, in a sense, we have to, unless if we go to places where people are really extremists or are really provoked by following our fiqh, we have to follow the same way we are, perform things the same way we are doing, and people should understand that there's a difference between us, Shia and Sunni fiqh. This is what I think.
Thank you. Any sisters?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much. Even among the suyas, like we don't pay on a sajda. And I feel that, isn't it very important, is your connection with your Allah is more important. I know we have a belief that, but I think the most important part is your connection with Allah when you are praying is much more important compared to anything else. I mean,
you know, that's true. That connection is the soul of every worship. Worship without that connection is just like a body without soul. However, you notice, for example, when Allah is describing for us the limits of fasting, how meticulously he's saying that this is the time for beginning, this is the time for ending. We may say, okay, what may difference it makes if we, for example, break our fast a few minutes before? The important thing is that we make our connection during the fast with Allah. There are certain rulings for everything that we have to follow. And in Salat, one of the things for the Shia is to, of course, pray on that turba. We can say this with regards to the very act of sajda completely, you know, that, okay, what's the point of putting our head down? We can just have our hearts humbled to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala instead of putting our forehead on the floor. So, since these are the rulings which are well-defined in Sharia, we have to follow them.
No, but was Rasulullah, during the time of Prophet, they sort of argue that during the time of Rasulullah, he never used to use the sajda. So that's the argument they keep it forward to us, that you are not following what Rasulullah used to do.
They never used sajda?
Yeah.
You
they
know,
never had the kunut.
Turba or sajda, which one? Turba. Well, the mosque, of course, didn't have anything, any carpet or anything. They prayed on what is acceptable as sujood. Now, you know, there's sometimes this false idea in our minds that Ahlus Sunnah means those who follow Sunnah of the Prophet, and others, or Shia, means those who do not follow the Sunnah of the Prophet. This Ahlus Sunnah and Jama'ah has come later on. It doesn't refer to Sunnah of the Prophet. It either refers to Sunnah of the Shaykhain that Imam Ali rejected to follow when he was given the option to become Caliph on the condition that he would follow Sunnah of the Prophet and Sunnah of Shaykhain. And Imam Ali said, or Quran, Sunnah of the Prophet, Sunnah. Imam Ali said, I follow Sunnah of the Prophet and the Quran, but I do not follow Sunnah of the Shaykhain. Now, those who followed this Sunnah were called Ahlul Sunnah. Otherwise, everyone, of course, all of us are following Sunnah of the Prophet. Now, was Prophet doing Salat the way we are doing? We believe yes. Because the Sunnah of the Prophet is known by Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq much better by Imam Abu Hanifa or Imam Malik or any other Imam. And therefore, we believe that, yes, Prophet prayed while his hands was down on his thigh rather than tied to each other. It is not, we believe, of course, with all due respect to those who believe Prophet was praying in that way, but we believe that Prophet did not pray in that way. Why? Because Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq has told us this is the way the Prophet did. So all of us are trying to follow the Sunnah of the Prophet, but we believe that the way we perform things is much closer to Sunnah of the Prophet than the way others do it.
Thank you. Very last one. Just a quick one. Okay, thank you.
I can leave it for next week. It might take more discussion, but let me try. I'm thankful to Razia and Riaz's points, and I think I track back. So, for example, in this center, there were few Ahl Sunnah, and you were leading the prayer. Perhaps you would, before the start of the prayer, just explain to them that at the end of the second rakat, you are going to recite kunut, so that they don't go to ruku, which quite often happens as well. So I think that little bit of education would be good. I also agree I also still maintain that in a Sunni Regent's Park type of mosque, or Wembley Mosque, where I don't go, you would want to do the least that is going to be provocative. But can I just say, let's just go back to the basics. Why do I feel that the Ahl Sunnah have to be amongst us? I think the main reason, I think, if I really try and ask myself, is for me to able to tell them in the best manner what you have just explained in the last 2-3 minutes. Yeah. So for example, about Imam Jafar Sadiq compared to others and the difference between Sunnah of Shaykhain, etc. How would I get an opportunity to talk to them if they are away from me? And if I reject them from the first instant? To get them into our fold, so to speak, for them to come and have play with us, a game of sports, for them to come and have a meal with us, for them to come and interact with us, you have to actually, initially at least, show tolerance, if you like, be least provocative, and then it's the best milieu then for them to learn and understand us slowly. So what I'm really trying to say that if, for example, when the Salam Center is up and running, I'm not going to make a decision. So Salam Center vision, as we all know, is quite different. It's something that we haven't done this before. There'll be many times we'll fall and we'll pick up ourselves. So I'm making a statement here just as my personal thoughts. It's not necessarily the trustees or the councillors' thoughts. So I would want people to be attracted to this center of all faiths and no faiths. To be attracted to the center so that they can sit and they can be amongst us. And amongst us, we are now powerful enough, and particularly our youth, are intelligent enough that they can have a dialogue and they can interact with society at large and not only communicate the Ahlul Bayt, the madhab, the values of those, but at the same time defend anything said. But you have to get these people into the fold, so to speak. It has to be inviting enough, the environment, for them to come, and then you try and interact with them as subtly as possible. So the ulterior aim is not necessarily to turn them into a Shi, if that happens, then it's Allah's will, but really for them to understand what we are and what our values are, so that when they then go out and meet their friends, they have learned from us, they've understood. Because yes, of course, no Sunni Imam will tell them what the Shia say. I mean, you are unique. Quite often during your talks, you actually say, this is what the Maliki said, this is what the Hanafi says, etc. Do you think in a Sunni mosque necessarily they say, well, this is what the Jafri school of thought is? Probably very little. But we would want them to listen about the Jafri school of thought's reasoning behind that. So we have to get them in. So what I'm really saying that when the time comes, inshallah, we might have to do things to soften the environment, to not make it provocative, and be inviting enough, and then slowly and slowly try and let them learn from us. But we have to think, how do we do it? What do we do it? What do we drop? What don't we drop?
Inshallah, the Salam Center gets up and running, we will think about this.
Well, there is one area where, just to comment on Nizaz, is that Sunni ulama have come out in explaining is about the Salah, Maghrib and Isha, and Dawr and Asr. Many ulama, I've heard myself, big three ulamas have said that there is no harm in reciting this Salah one after another. Prophet used to do it. And three of them have come out quite openly to explain there's no harm.
Mm-hmm.
And because many of the Sunnis were avoiding, you see, once they've done Dawr, they would miss because they are in the work or what, and then they would pray with the Qadha as with Maghrib. So,
yeah. One thing which is very, very clear is that we have to continue interact with the bigger Muslim community. We are only 15-20% of Muslims. They are 80% of Muslims. And as A'im alayhi salam said, do not argue with them, but just tell them mahasana kalamina. Teach them what we say. Tell them if they find out the beauty of what A'im alayhi salam have said, then they would at least understand and honor and respect. So the interaction is very, very important, I think. We have to find ways for it.
Thank you, Muhammad Wali Muhammad Sheikh. So we continue next week, inshallah.